So I decided to take this opportunity and discuss with you two topics. One will be some material issues in ferromagnetic semiconductors, and in the second half I'll talk about anisotropic magneto resistance effects in gallium manganese arsenide nanostructures. And the original work I'm going to report on to in this talk has been a result of a wide collaboration of people from my own institutions in Prague and in Nottingham, but also many other people from Hitachi, Cambridge, universities in Texas, people from Würzburg and Pisa. So, instead of an introduction, I'm just going to wrap up quickly what we understand about the material properties of the current high-quality gallium manganese arsenide, and then discuss some related materials, and in particular try to think if we can somehow increase the Curie temperature in materials that are closely related to gallium manganese arsenide by tuning some other parameters, and also see if we can possibly make an analogous ferromagnetic semiconductors to gallium manganese arsenide, but which will be n-type. And in the second part, I will then talk about these anisotropic magnetoresistance effects. So, gallium manganese arsenide is a dilute magnetic semiconductor, and just all the basic properties of this semiconductor really are derived from, if you just look up the periodic table and compare gallium and manganese, and you see where when manganese substitutes for gallium, it's a magnetic impurity because it has only five electrons in the magnetic D shell. Most naturally, it would act as an acceptor because of this one missing p electron in the three. Actually, it's supposed to be four p shell here. And so it's actually it's quite a remarkable material because you have one of the most common semiconductors, gallium arsenide, and you only add one additional dopant in the systems, and that does it all for you. It provides for the local moment, it also provides for the holes, and these holes then mediate the ferromagnetic coupling between the local moments. There are two questions I'm going to ask. One is that what are the intrinsic properties of this material? So what do we expect, at least theoretically, of this material to behave? Then I'm going to also talk about the extrinsic properties which seem to limit TC for various reasons. And so from the intrinsic point of view, so this is some typical results of some typical calculations for this material, but it really doesn't matter whether you use some effective Hamiltonian approach for this kinetic exchange type of interaction, or whether you do use a microscopic tight binding approximation or LDA plus U theories. They all gives you a very similar qualitative picture of magnetic properties. I'm not saying that they all give you the same quantitative predictions for critical temperatures, but I actually think that there is no quantitatively accurate theory anyway for TC, so all that has to be taken more qualitatively than precisely. Precise values of TC. And so what these calculations tell us are the following. So the points I plot here are in this left diagram are the dependence of the critical temperature scaled by the concentration of manganese here, so divided by the manganese doping, as a function of the hole density for different local moment concentrations here. So here I'm assuming that these two quantities can be independent, which is true if you add some additional compensating defects, for example. And what you see here, if you look at those gold triangles here, so these are points that would, at this part of the diagram at least, would correspond to low hole densities and very high local moment concentrations. As you see, actually the mean field prediction for the TC start to give you a negative value, which means that the system is not ferromagnetic at all, the ferromagnetism is not stable. And the reason for that the TC becomes very small at these highly compensated systems, especially if you have large number of the local moments, is that you will have to have increasing probability of having near neighbor local moments, and these guys couple antiferromagnetically due to the short range super exchange. To get a ferromagnetism for that, this ferromagnetism is mediated by the carriers through some kind of a RKKY type of interaction. So that's why critical temperature rapidly increases as you add holes here. But what happens, and at very large hole concentration, and now we can focus, for example, at these black points here. So these points correspond to low local moment density. And as you increase the hole density here, you see that actually TC starts to decrease again. And the reason for that is that if the number of holes per moment becomes too large, you get from a ferromagnetic coupling regime into a frustrated RKKY regime where some of the manganese are coupled ferromagnetically, some are coupled antiferromagnetically. And that happens when the wavelength, Fermi wavelength of these itinerant holes in the system become, let's say, comparable to the average distance between the local moments, or at some ratio of these two quantities, the system becomes unstable. You can replot these curves into one universal behavior if you just replace the hole density with something which is like a compensation of the number of holes per local moment density here. And again, TC here is scaled by the number of local moments. And then all the points seems to collapse to something like a universal behavior, which just tells you that that TC is linear in the number of local moments here. That's what the scaling says. That TC falls very rapidly to small values if the compensation becomes larger than, let's say, 50%. And on the other hand, if the compensation is not too large, if you have more than half hole per manganese, then the TC becomes fairly independent of the hole density in the system. So that's what you would expect based on many different approaches, would be the intrinsic properties of gallium manganese arsenide. Now, in experiment, you certainly deal with a real material, and in real material, there is one very important extrinsic effect, which has been now observed in virtually every molecular beam epitaxy-grown system, and that's the tendency to self-compensate. When you add manganese in the system, in the gallium arsenide, you tend to get some manganese, not in the substitutional positions, but also in an interstitial position. And the reason for that is very physical. It's because gallium arsenide is a nearly covalent semiconductor. And covalent semiconductors, they just don't like being doped at all. They just want to remain semiconducting. Once you start to add manganese, a substitutional manganese, it's an acceptor. So you're moving Fermi energy either to the valence, you're moving the Fermi energy to the valence band, and you're losing some of the occupied bonding states in your system, and that increases the energy. And so the system tries to do anything what it can to keep the Fermi energy mid-gap. And so that's one of the reasons why actually it's very hard to get manganese into the gallium arsenide, and people have to go to low temperature non-equilibrium growth to be even able to grow this material at high enough manganese concentrations for ferromagnetism, which is above 1%. But even if you grow the material at low temperature with low temperature molecular beam epitaxy, you still see the tendency to self-compensation, and manganese interstitials are the most natural and most common impurities that compensate holes introduced by manganese, because these guys now act as double donors. So manganese is really manganese interstitial is really a magnesium killer in the system, because it compensates the holes, and we need the holes for median ferromagnetism between the local moments. But not just that, because manganese interstitial is a donor, substitutional manganese is an acceptor, so they will have an opposite charge, and during the synthesis of the material, they will be attracted to each other. But when they are attracted to each other, are near neighbors, then the short distance super exchange interaction, which is antiferromagnetic, would start to dominate. And so if you look at this complex, it behaves effectively as a spin zero. So the interstitial manganese not just kills the hole, but it also kills the moment of the substitutional manganese. Now, obviously the fundamental question for this for this property is that how much interstitial manganese you're going to get in the system when you grow the material. And so this is a curve here which shows, or a diagram here which shows a partial concentration of the substitutional and interstitial manganese as a function of the total doping here. So this is now 4%, 8%, 12% of manganese. And the dots here are experimental data, And the solid lines are not fits. These are theoretical calculations of these partial concentration based on the equilibrium formation energies of these two defects, calculated from either ab initio or microscopic tight binding bend structure. And as you see that the experiment and theory are in quite a good agreement, and what these data tells us is that yes, as you keep increasing doping of your system, you will get more and more of these interstitial manganese. That obviously is a bad news, but the good news here is that we don't see any signs of saturation of the concentration of the substitutional manganese. So it's true that you will get more and more interstitials, but actually the number of substitutional manganese still seems to go up as you increase the total doping, and there doesn't seem to be any saturation. So at the moment, the typical concentration, the highest concentrations grown so far, around 10%. So we should be able to get more substitutional manganese if we get larger total concentration of manganese. Now here is a critical temperature. These are again experimental data only in this case. And what you see here, these open symbols and these half open symbols, these are critical temperature for as grown materials. So they have the a partial density, partial concentration of interstitial and substitutional manganese I showed you on the previous transparency. Yes.
Go ahead. Do we know what the interaction is between two substitutional manganese, mm-hmm. which are nearest neighbor?
There is going to be antiferromagnetic.
And
antiferromagnetic.
So in some sense, even if you didn't have any interstitial, just a substitution, at some stage there,
I think
that superexcited antiferromagnetism would become important.
Okay, so this is the diagram. I think you just I missed that diagram. So I was talking about intrinsic properties of a manganese. Of substitutional manganese doped gallium arsenide. And this is exactly what you see. If you have low hole density and here is a high concentration of manganese, you see a strong tendency of suppressed ferromagnetism, even a negative TC on a mean field calculation, which means that ferromagnetism is unstable, and that's just because of these near neighbors manganese, which are antiferromagnetic.
Because we didn't know the theoretical consideration, I was just asking a simple atomic physics question. If two manganese are nearest mm-hmm. neighbor, the interaction will be antiferromagnetic.
There will be antiferromagnetic, yeah. It will compete with the carrier-mediated ferromagnetic interaction, but it's very strong. It's stronger than the carrier-mediated, so they will remain antiferromagnetic.
Right. So you don't want to increase the manganese concentration forever, is what I'm saying. There'll
yeah,
be some place
exactly.
That will come down. And,
also for that reason.
What is the modern theory and so on.
Yeah. Okay, so these are the as-grown materials, and as you see, you have a clear saturation of TC. But if you anneal the materials, and that's actually very nice of the material physics in this subject, is that if you anneal materials after the growth, your TC goes up, and the reason for that is that you're getting rid of these interstitial manganese. They're just out-diffused from the system. And it's because these interstitial manganese, their energy in the lattice is much smaller, their bonding is much weaker than the bonding of the substitutional manganese. So at temperatures which are just slightly above growth temperature, or even at the growth temperature, annealing temperatures, you can get rid of these interstitial manganese. And so what you left is just a substitutional, more or less. And as you see, the critical temperature increases dramatically. So now the question is, are these data consistent with the predictions or with the expectations of the theory? So to make any sensible comparison, we have to do the following, or we think we have to do the following. We have to plot these experimental data not as a function of nominal doping, but as a function of some effective local moment doping, where we subtract this effectively zero spin near neighbor interstitial and substitutional pairs. And so if you do that, you see that really you have a nice linear dependence of TC on for all these data on the effective moment doping, except for these half open symbols. And these half open symbols are the as grown materials which have very large hole compensation.
Are there any way of checking where the annealed manganese goes and how much of it has gone?
Right. So what you can do is you can measure, there have been several experiments looking at interstitials, but what you can certainly do is measure hole density. And if you in some sense believe in your nominal doping, then from the nominal concentration and from the hole density for as grown material and annealed material, you can get an idea how much manganese interstitials you got rid of after the annealing. But there.
But then that's not very material specific. It tells you what. That something has happened, but it doesn't tell you what has happened. I mean, there's more proof that it's interstitial.
Oh, there's.
Well, simply you can see that manganese segregation has been surfaced.
Oh, yeah, there has been. Yeah, there has been. It has been detected by many techniques, by Auger spectroscopy, and this has been detected by this Rutherford channeling experiments where they were looking into the interstitial in the lattice, and after annealing they were gone. So yeah, there's many evidence of that.
And how is the hole density?
Well, the hole density in this particular case was measured by Hall effect measurements at high magnetic fields, and that probably produces the largest error bar. But I'm going to show the next transparency is going to be shown with the error bars for the experimental data. So obviously there is some error bar for the doping, although we think that this can be the nominal manganese concentration can be defined within 10%. Probably the Hall measurement are the largest error bars. And the reason for that is really physical. It's because it's not a simple single-band model where you know that Hall effect gives you exact value of the carrier concentration. Here you are in valence band, which is more complicated band structure. You have spin orbit coupling, and you have also anomalous Hall effect contribution. But from the calculations we did, we are quite confident that the error bar of the Hall effect is around 20% at saturation.
The only point I want to make here is the law of theory experiment fitting in getting this Hall density. Mm-hmm. Usually it says we get it from Hall measurement, making it sound like an ordinary two-dimensional semiconductor. You measure Hall effect, you immediately know the density. You don't need any theory. The straight line, I don't know.
But that
this is not that way.
Certainly not the case, because
highly misleading, just saying Hall effect measure the density. Tremendous amount of theory experiment fitting that reasonable people could disagree.
I absolutely agree that it's not straightforward, and so you need to do very detailed calculations to see if that fitting makes any sense. Right. And so we think that it still works pretty well. We think that it actually works better than in gallium arsenide without manganese and comparable hole densities. And the reason why it works better is that the manganese and the ferromagnetism makes the bands more stiff, so they look more like a nice bands without spin orbit interaction. So it seems to be slightly better, at least from the calculations we did, than for the pure gallium arsenide. But obviously there is going to be a substantial error bar on that. There is a fairly good confidence, though, in the Hall density within this error bar compared to, if you do the experiment and compare it with the CV profiling, which again has some error bars, but the figures you get from these two experiments, which are completely independent, are similar. Again, with these error bars, this is the results which you get if you collapse all the experimental data. This is something like a 14 different experimental points. If you collapse them, plot it as a function of the compensation here, or Hall density per effective now local moment density, and you scale it with the concentration of the local moments here, and you see that the behavior that is expected based on theory, and again, don't take this very quantitatively, is that indeed at large enough Hall densities, that means when the compensation is not that big, smaller than 40%, let's say, there is no obviously strong dependence on the Hall concentration. It only becomes apparent when you have large compensation. And again, these are the three or four half open symbols. So these were the samples which, as grown, showed a large degree of compensation here. And that's where you start to lose ferromagnetism. Other than that, it seems to scale nicely linearly with effective local moment concentration. And just to show you an example, so this is the current record, TC record, gallium manganese arsenide, which has some 173K critical temperature. And as you see, this is the magnetization curve, which looks very nicely mean field-like. So even the highest TC material so far seems to be a very nice, robust mean field-like ferromagnet. So just to wrap up this part, this is where we are with gallium manganese arsenide at the moment. So we need to increase TC beyond the current record. We certainly seem to needs to increase the concentration of these effective uncompensated local moments. TC doesn't seem to saturate, so we think that we can still increase the TC in these materials. Note that the current record material has only 6.2% of these effective local moments doping. The other thing which I think is a fairly good news is that the charge compensation is not that dramatic. I mean, unless compensation is larger than 40%, the TC doesn't seem to care much and will remain fairly high. So from these points of view, it seems that at the moment the barrier is not really physical for increasing TC in this system, but it's more technological. How can we get more manganese into the system? And for that, you need to precisely control gross temperature stoichiometry. And if you do that, I think there's a very reasonable expectation that TC will go above 200 Kelvin. Yes?
With the plane from Japan, I'm not seeing TC is about 250 K, so based on what you're saying, I assume you don't believe that.
I'm talking about bulk material, which I think is under much better control.
The TC is lower than bulk material.
The TC you referred to, I believe, is this Tanaka's experiment in the modulation doped system.
Everything in all the ferromagnetism says that 3D TC should be higher than 2D TC. So if they're claiming 250 K and 2D, the corresponding TC should be higher. But I just want to understand how you opinion. I don't care. Since you are not mentioning that, am I correct to assume that you don't believe that experiment?
I think that these experiments in the bulk material are now very well established. I don't think that the experiment in this modulation dope is very well established. Okay, and obviously, so from here, obviously, if we want to use exactly this material for application, we need to go by a factor of two higher in TC at least. So what can we do about that? How can we increase critical temperature? So I think a good starting point for thinking of closely related materials is to look at this diagram, which sometimes is called an internal reference rule diagram. And so what this diagram tells us is the following. We have the different 3-5 hosts here. So these are the indium-based hosts, these are gallium 3-5 hosts, and these are aluminum-based 3-5 hosts here. And they are arranged here. So this is the energy, basically the edges of the valence band, and these are the edges of the conduction band of the particular 3-5 semiconductor here. And they are arranged here in this diagram according to the respective band offset. So if you grow, let's say, a gallium arsenide on top of gallium phosphide, if we could do that, this would be the respective band offset in the valence, in the conduction band, and this would be the offset in the valence band. So that's how these 3-5 hosts are organized here. And then what is shown here are the manganese-derived levels in these hosts. And because manganese, at least in this picture, the properties of the manganese are mostly atomic-like, then the D level, the position of the D level, which is the majority spin level of manganese, will be fairly constant if you go across the family of these 3-5 semiconductors when these bands are aligned according to their respective band offsets. The same would apply to the minority D level, which is the in atomic manganese, this is the empty D level here, which are split by the strong correlation energy. And the same would also apply to the manganese acceptor level in these 3-5 semiconductors. And so based on this picture, you can arrive at this three, let's say, qualitatively different behaviors you can get in the 3-5 semiconductors when you start to dope them with a large amount of manganese. So the first class of materials would be this one, would be the materials where the hybridization between these D electrons. Yes, go ahead.
Is that axis, is that the right energy dense?
I think it's fairly correct.
Milli electron volt or electron volt?
This should be electron volt, so it's not the right energy unit. Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking of Rydbergs. No, it's the UVs. Yeah. It should be electron volt here. Okay, so the first class of materials, that would be the materials which are which are the large lattice constant, small gap materials. So these are basically the materials like indium arsenide, if you look. So large atoms, we are going down in the periodic table. We are having large lattice constants and small gaps. And so these materials, because they have large lattice constant, they would have a fairly weak hybridization between the d levels and the p orbitals of the host bands. And these, obviously, this hybridization is behind the magnetic coupling in the system. And so if we have the a fairly weak hybridization, then that also corresponds to the fact that the acceptor level is close to the edge of the valence band. And so manganese will be a very efficient acceptor, will weakly hybridize with host states. And we have, as an efficient acceptor, it would provide delocalized hosts, which would virtually occupy the host semiconductor valence band. And this type of picture seemed to apply to the narrower gap materials, larger lattice constant materials like indium antimonide, indium arsenide, and we think that also gallium arsenide more or less belongs to that category here. What you see as far as TCs are concerned, as you go from the large lattice constant, smaller gap materials, you have a TC of about 7 Kelvin, and as you go, that means in indium antimonide, and as you reach gallium arsenide, the record is something like 173 at the moment. Now, what happens if you try to make this hybridization stronger by making the lattice constant smaller? That means by going to higher elements that are higher in the periodic table. So it would correspond, for example, if you go from gallium arsenide to gallium phosphide and maybe eventually to gallium nitride. So you're making the lattice smaller. That means that the hybridization between the d and p orbitals on the neighboring lattice side will be stronger here. And also you would move the d level higher with respect to the valence band edge. So for example, this is gallium arsenide edge and gallium nitride here. The distance is much smaller. But that's not the only thing that happens. You would also move the manganese acceptor level higher in the gap. So if you compare gallium arsenide, the acceptor level is somewhere here, about 100 MeV. For gallium nitride, it's almost mid-gap here, or maybe perfectly mid-gap. When you make the hybridization stronger and stronger, also your manganese is less and less efficient acceptor. And so you can have this sort of an intermediate scenario where you have a fairly strong hybridization, but holes will occupy an impurity band, which is not going to merge with the host semiconductor band, so will be in a detached impurity band from the host band structure. And so in this regime, both the conduction and the coupling of the manganese will be through hopping within this impurity band, and that will make the magnetic interaction having a much shorter range. So at the moment, experimentally at least, it seems that gallium phosphide is an example of that sort of behavior. These experimentalists claim to see a clear hole-mediated ferromagnetism, but in the same time to see clear indications of the impurity band. Again, I don't think that physics of gallium phosphide is established, certainly not as well as in gallium manganese arsenide. So it could be that the occurrence of the impurity band is not just due to the manganese, but also due to other extrinsic defects in the material.
So saying that the physics of gallium manganese arsenide is well established, let's say, but not gallium phosphide, you are then ignoring this recent experimental results from San Diego, Santa Barbara, but
Okay, so let me put it another way. What I meant here was that there is a lot of experimental studies in gallium manganese arsenide. Many of the studies, experimental and theoretical studies, many of the studies suggesting that gallium manganese arsenide is a nice metallic system. Some of the experiments suggesting that they may be explained in terms of the impurity band. I take your point. What I meant here is
not my point. I don't have a huge point.
No,
it's experimental is to have explained rather common. When you're saying it's well established, it makes it sound like there's a consensus. That definitely is not a consensus, because there are equilibrium levels. Mm-hmm. Equilibrium has nothing to do with the systems, a metal or insulator. Okay, you can have a metal, mm-hmm. an entirely equilibrium metal. This is the elementary source of physics. The fact that it's a metal, I don't know, that's a red herring. I don't know why you keep on harping on that. It could be a metal, which has nothing to do with balance. That's the thing. They are not staying.
So we can, and if anybody is interested in the details of the discussion of the picture of ferromagnets and gallium arsenide, we can discuss it about in detail after the talk. I wanted to focus on some other aspects. So I agree. I can at the moment. Let me say the following: there is a number of experiments that support this picture, and there are experiments that are interpreted in the more that it's a impurity band picture. What I was trying to say here was that in gallium phosphide, on the other hand, there is virtually only one group that has been reporting a nice carrier-mediated ferromagnetism in this material, and that those results seems to be more supporting the picture of an impurity band. Okay. And the reason why I'm saying that this may be intrinsic to the gallium phosphide, but maybe extrinsic because of some other impurities, is because that this material has been grown by different techniques than these materials, and there certainly is not an extensive material research in this material yet that would establish the nature of the ferromagnetism in this material. So this is the second possibility you can have. Another thing I would like to emphasize is these are not like two completely different systems. I mean, there is just a continuous transition from this type of picture to that type of picture. But what can happen if you go to even larger gap materials is the following: that actually manganese is not an acceptor at all. It will undergo a phase transition, if you want, from a D5 type of acceptor state into an isovalent D4 state. So the manganese will completely give up the fifth electron. It would completely participate in bonding, and it will not be an acceptor at all. And in that type of picture here, which may apply to the gallium nitrides, it's not established yet. In that type of picture, manganese is not going to supply holes. So if you want to have any carrier-mediated coupling, you need to have additional doping. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand this.
Okay.
Side.
Yes.
So it looks like the zero of the energy is set by the top of the valence band in gallium arsenide.
I think that's the zero of the energy, yes.
And then, so if I want to understand the manganese acceptor level, it looks like it resides about 2 electron volts above the top of the valence band in gallium nitride, for example.
No. It's very 2 electron volts, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, something like that. Mid gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it's actually in the valence band for indium and germanium.
That's what the internal reference rule tells you. What the experiment, I don't think there is any experimental study, certainly experimental study of gallium phosphide, gallium arsenide, and aluminum arsenide. And that, for these materials, this internal reference rule is nearly exact.
What is the internal reference rule based on?
The internal reference rule is just a rule of thumb that tells you that that manganese will have mostly atomic-like character in these 3-5 hosts. And so that the splitting would be given by the splitting of the atomic D levels. And then the rest of the energy, how to align the D levels with respect to the to the edges of the bands, would be just according to how these bands are aligned if you grow the heterostructures. Okay. So it's a hand waving argument, let's say. Okay. But if you, for example, would really put here experimental acceptor level for gallium arsenide, which is 110 millielectron volts here above the valence band, and you would use this internal reference rule, you will get some 400 MeV for gallium phosphide and 400 MeV for aluminum arsenide, and that really seems to be work very well with experiment. We know that in indium antimonide or indium arsenide, it's again a very good acceptor. And indium antimonide in particular has very large mobilities, like order of magnitudes larger than gallium arsenide, for example, but has very small TC because it's a large lattice constant system. It's hard to believe that in indium antimonide the acceptor level would be deep in the gap, deep in the band. So it will So that's probably a regime where this internal reference rule breaks. Okay. But it just, again, tells you it's going to be somewhere very close to the edge. Okay. Okay, so so if we go to these heavy element materials which have large lattice constants, small gaps, we will have a very nice robust ferromagnet, but the TCs are going to be probably very low. If we go towards these materials, the problem is that if you get to the regime of highly localized holes, then also the magnetic interactions will not be long range anymore, and that will also again suppress critical temperature. So the high TCs, we're going to try to look for the high TCs somewhere in between these two regimes, somewhere at the border between these two regimes.
Can you make
Yes, so that's what I'm going to do now. Yes. And so we're going to do the following. We're going to do a mixed crystals of aluminum. Of aluminum gallium arsenide and gallium arsenide phosphide. And we think that these two ternaries are choosing phosphorus, and aluminum is quite interesting, maybe from the theoretical point of view, because they may look like identical hosts. Because if you look at gallium phosphide here and you look at aluminum arsenide, they have nearly the same gap, and actually they are also nearly perfectly matched as far as their band edges are concerned here. So from just the band structure, it seems like adding manganese into aluminum arsenide or gallium phosphide should give you the same result. But you can test one important physical aspect here is that it's not just the band alignments here, maybe with respect to the d levels, but what also matters is really the strength of the hybridization between the orbitals, which is given by the lattice constant in the material. And despite this very similar band structure, the lattice constant in gallium phosphide is much smaller than the lattice constant in aluminum arsenide. And not just that, actually, aluminum arsenide has a nearly identical lattice constant with gallium arsenide. So here is the picture. The band alignments are nearly similar in the two hosts with 100% phosphorus or 100% aluminum. But if you look at the lattice constant with increasing concentration of the wide gap material, the lattice constant of aluminum is nearly constant. So that just confirms the fact that gallium arsenide and aluminum arsenide are lattice matched materials, and you can grow heterostructures very easily. On the other hand, if you go to gallium phosphide here, the lattice constant is suppressed dramatically. And so now you can make an estimate of how is the TC going to behave in these materials. And that can be estimated just based on this Kondo PD coupling constant here. And this Kondo constant here scales with the hybridization potential square and also scales with the difference of the position of the manganese D levels from the Fermi energy, the majority and the minority here. So if you look at the formula here, you see that if you move your band edge here in the material closer to the manganese D level, you will increase this parameter here, and that should increase the coupling constant here. But on the other hand, if you move that level closer to, if you move the edge of the valence band closer to this D level, the majority D level, you move it further from the minority D level, and that also comes into play here in this scenario. So if the change is not very large, then the increase of that parameter here, which corresponds to the distance from the majority level, will be almost perfectly compensated by the decrease of this parameter, which is the distance from the minority level here. So for the small shifts in the band offset, the relatively small shifts with respect to the gallium arsenide, this term here is going to give you a relatively small increase in the expected critical temperature by only 4%. And that will be the same, that should be the same for the phosphorus and for the aluminum arsenide here. But this hybridization parameter, that's the parameter that depends on the lattice constant, that will be that will change much more dramatically. And the reason for that is that that the hybridization square scales as lattice constant to minus 7 here. So if you just work out all the lattice constant parameters in your TC formula here, you have a factor of lattice constant to minus 11 of scaling of TC. So even though this change in lattice constant is only 5%, it eventually should lead to a 50% increase of the gallium phosphide critical temperature, just based on this mean field estimates here. Yes? That's pretty good, isn't it?
I'm not
So manganese, atomic manganese, is a zero orbital momentum state, perfect spin 5/2. So you don't expect any spin orbit coupling. And as long as it behaves like this in the alloy, that's what you expect. Certainly, if you have some, if you have this D4 state, for example, this D4 state would not have the symmetry at all. And that would be a completely different picture. But as long as it's a D5 state, that fairly is a fairly accurate description. Okay?
How the second order process is when you pop onto this nice
and easy,
there'll be some
fungible coupling,
I guess.
Right. So, how you arrive at this is that you start from your Anderson Hamiltonian, where you have your Hubbard and you have hybridization, and you can actually make a transformation, which is called a Schrieffer-Wolf transformation, where you transform out the hybridization term. Okay, and as long as this Hubbard coupling is strong compared to the hybridization, you can do that. And if you do that, that's exactly the effective interaction. So instead of hybridization, that's what you get.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the calculator.
Yeah.
But definitely the denominators are more complicated than against that.
Well, okay, so
you're saying that it's the Hubbard U dominates everything, that's what you get.
So what you have in these systems, you have some Hubbard coupling, which tells you how much energy you have, how much energy you add to the system if we have double occupied orbital. But for this five, for the d orbital, you have obviously also a Heisenberg exchange that actually forces all the spins to align. Okay, and so what I'm showing here is these ed up and ed downs, they are a combination of the Hubbard and the Heisenberg exchange constants. Okay, and actually the difference between this these two levels, the energy difference is a Hubbard U plus 5 exchange. Hubbard U plus 5 Heisenberg J's. So I just lumped all these parameters into these two formal expressions. So, and also the other thing is that obviously this simple expression only applies at the gamma point. If you go off the gamma point, this parameter depends on the KK prime from where you scatter to which K point you scatter. But assuming that you're at the gamma point, this is a constant. Okay, so this is just based on these simple expectations, you expect that nothing much is going to happen in aluminum arsenide or alloying gallium arsenide with aluminum, but you can get some substantial increase of TC if you go to towards gallium phosphide. Okay, so that was just making some very simple estimates. So here, these are the real calculations based on the microscopic tight binding, so you don't impose any, you don't do any Schrieffer-Wolf transformation, you just calculate your band structure from including the hybridization and including the correlation terms. So this is how this Kondo JPD constant behaves for, as you increase the content of the wide gap material, for aluminum gallium arsenide host, and here this is for gallium arsenide phosphide host. And as expected, the JPD doesn't change much in aluminum, but changes quite a bit for the aluminum arsenide phosphorus. And actually, if you look at this increase, it perfectly corresponds to what you would estimate from based on the Schrieffer-Wolf transformation. And then you can calculate the mean field TC for that from that band structure, and you get a very small increase for the aluminum arsenide. So what I plot here is just the gallium arsenide phosphide for 5% and 10% of manganese. And again, it works nearly perfectly with the estimate. It's just get increased the TC by some 50%. So it seems like we understand, although gallium phosphide and aluminum arsenide may look like a very similar material, it's only the gallium phosphide or gallium arsenide phosphide where you would expect to get larger TC. And obviously the problem now is that as you go to the wider gap material, your holes become more localized. So the question is whether this localization and the shorter range of interaction is not going to suppress the TC. And at least from these calculations, we don't see any dramatic suppression of the range of the magnetic interaction as you go from gallium arsenide to gallium phosphide. But obviously, if you want to get an ND grower motivated to look into phosphorus, they don't like phosphorus. So it would be good to have another good point to add to this, so not just the TC increase. And the other point we think can be quite important is the formation energy of manganese. And the whole idea behind this argument is that as you go to the wider gap materials, your crystals becomes more ionic. And as the crystal become more ionic, then the tendency to self-compensate becomes weaker and weaker. And it's actually very well known for gallium nitride that gallium nitride with manganese can be grown under equilibrium condition, and you can add 10% of manganese, no problem. It's probably connected with the fact that manganese is not a good acceptor, so it doesn't need to compensate for that. In gallium arsenide, it is a big problem. So this is the figure which I showed before, where you tend to get these interstitial manganese that they try to compensate for the substitutional. So the question we asked was how this partial concentration of interstitial manganese would look in a ternary alloy here, where we would add phosphorus into the host here. So here I just plot, it's again the same microscopic calculations of the partial concentration based on the formation energies of these defects. And what I plot here is only now this interstitial manganese partial concentration for different concentrations of phosphorus here. So this green curve is basically this red curve, this blue curve. They correspond to each other. And then these two other curves, they correspond to higher content or high concentration of phosphorus. So as you see that just by adding 25% of phosphorus, the formation energy or the partial concentration of interstitial manganese is already decreased substantially. And what was a big surprise to us, I must say, is that at 50% of phosphorus, at least theoretically from these calculations, we won't get any interstitial manganese at all. So this seems to be like the other good reason or good motivation for experimentalists to look into the system is it's not just that the TC we expect, it can give you this 50% enhancement, but also you might be able to get more substitutional manganese in the system at higher growth temperature. So the overall quality of the material could be better than the quality of the low temperature grown gallium manganese arsenide. Right. So these particular calculations for the phosphorus were done within the tight binding model, where all the off-diagonal hybridization integrals were recalculated according to the different lattice constant. Okay. In these calculations, no, we didn't allow for local relaxations. These calculations were done for the gallium manganese arsenide were done by both microscopic tight binding and also by LDA calculation, which did allow for local relaxations. This calculation have not yet been done, including this effect. But in the case of gallium manganese arsenide, the fully up initio and the tight binding were in perfect agreement. Obviously, here the effects can be stronger. I agree with that. Okay, so I think I must be over time terribly, right? When did we start? So let me just put one more or two more transparency if I can. Yes.
I want to ask related to this phosphorus, why is it that experimentalists don't like it so much in the NDE?
Because it sets on fire if you open the NDE, it's phosphorus.
I mean, the other materials they have in the NDE are...
Yeah, arsenic is not a very nice material, obviously. You get nice shiny hair, but other than that, it doesn't help. But phosphorus is really a problem. But people know how to handle it.
They put in the NDE are such that this becomes an issue.
Yeah. But there are, you know, gallium phosphide is now a routine semiconductor, and the reason for that is it has lattice match with silicon. So silicon industry is interested in an optically active lattice matched material. Precautions are quite... So really, I mean, it's not easy for a gallium arsenide growers to jump on gallium phosphide immediately, but it's possible. Let me just flesh out one or two more transparencies where I'd like to address this point. So far we just discussed manganese in some 3-5 hosts like gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide, gallium phosphide here. And the very neat thing, I believe, of these materials is that you just need one single element, additional element, and put it into a most common semiconductors and you get nice ferromagnetism. But with this simplicity also brings inevitably limits to the system. And that one we saw already and discussed was the manganese solubility limit in these materials because manganese is an acceptor. We also have correlated local moment and carrier densities because it's also an acceptor, so you don't have a good possibility to tune independently the local moment density and carrier density, which you would like to do, in especially in devices. And the most important thing is that so far you all these materials, because manganese is an acceptor, have been p-type, and it would be very nice, obviously, to have an n-type ferromagnet. And so here is the proposal we make for actually lifting all these limitations by making a very straightforward substitution. And the substitution goes as this equation, where 3 equals 1 plus 2, which in chemistry means that you would replace gallium with lithium plus zinc. And what you get doing with this transformation is the following. You get a twin semiconductor to a gallium arsenide, is this zinc, a lithium arsenide here. And it actually, if you look up the literature for a zinc lithium arsenide, you see that it really is a twin material. It has virtually the same crystal structure. It's a zinc blend zinc arsenide as it is for gallium arsenide, and lithium just fill the interstitial positions close to the four arsenic here. If you compare the band structure of the two materials, they have nearly the same band gap here. They have very similar band structures, band dispersions, effective masses, ground states, charge distribution, etc. It's simply as like you have a nearly identical semiconductor. Obviously, people didn't bother studying this semiconductor, using this semiconductor much, because lithium is a pain in the neck. It's a small element. It's very reactive. So it's much easier to go with gallium arsenide rather than zinc lithium arsenide. But for magnetic systems, we think it can have a rather important consequences. And the consequence number one is that manganese is not going to have any solubility limit in this material compared to gallium arsenide, and it's because manganese goes substitutional for the zinc. So it's an isovalent substitution, and here are again microscopic formation energy calculations for this material. All the formation energies are negative for substitutional manganese, which means it can go there freely compared to the large positive formation energies in gallium arsenide. So no problem to get manganese in there. I said it would be nice to have an n-type material. So here is a very natural way how to make this material n-type without adding any additional chemical in there. You just add more lithium interstitials here in the system. You go beyond the stoichiometry of the system. And here are the formation energies of these additional interstitial lithium. And again, they are negative. So the system is not going to have a big problem with incorporating these extra lithium impurities. And finally, these are the calculations of Curie temperatures, mean field Curie temperatures in the system. And what you see here is that these are on the p-type doping. So this is gallium arsenide, and this is the lithium zinc manganese arsenide calculated for two different configurations, but it doesn't matter for the moment here. And you see that that indeed even the magnetic properties of the two materials seems to be very similar. But what is remarkable is that you see a strong tendency to ferromagnetism in the n-type materials. In gallium manganese arsenide, it would be very difficult to make the n-type material in reality, but for lithium zinc arsenide host, it should be much, much easier. And now what's the reason for ferromagnetism in anti-material? The reason for that is that you won't get any strong ferromagnet if your carriers would be around the gamma point, because gamma point is formed by gallium S states and they don't hybridize with the D states. However, if you move the Fermi energy above this and you very quickly get the hybridization and you very quickly get to this L valley minimum where you have strong arsenic p orbital lead mixture, and that leads to hybridization and forms this ferromagnetic state. The ferromagnetism occurs at comparable electron dopings to the Hall dopings where you see ferromagnets in gallium manganese arsenide. Because it's the same
to occupy the L valley.
Again, it's the same physics like in the p-type material. First you have to compensate for the direct antiferromagnetic coupling, so that's why you have a negative TC at zero concentration or low concentration of carriers, whether p-type or n-type. Once you do that, your system becomes carrier-mediated ferromagnet. And the reason for that is that you have hybridization, and actually the hybridization cannot come from S-states. But S-states, it's only the gamma point in the conduction bed which is purely S-state, but as you move from the gamma point, you very quickly get some admixture of P-states and you get hybridization. And for the densities corresponding to where you should see strong ferromagnetism, you should already be close to the L-valley in both materials, whether it's a gallium arsenide or lithium zinc arsenide, the dense structures are very similar. Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
This lithium zinc material, according to your literature citations, mm-hmm. at least in theory, has been known and studied for some time. Are there any experiments already available for that kind of material? Or was it actually also some experimental data that you were looking
there? So Zünger, obviously, is theory.
Yeah.
And these guys are theory, and these two are just two examples of experiments. So lithium zinc arsenide is a very well-known semiconductor. It can be grown by direct synthesis of zinc, arsenic, and lithium. You just put the stuff in, cook it, and you get a nice zinc blend semiconductor. You don't even have to do MBE.
So in that sense, it's easier to handle than phosphorus or?
Not really, because what you would really want to do to have a high quality and put the manganese in there, you would probably prefer doing MBE.
Yeah.
But MBE, any small elements are a big problem. They just, because they cannot pump them out. So you usually have to sacrifice one MBE chamber for things like that. But also lithium, what I was told, obviously, I mean, we are thinking about it. But it's an issue having any reactive element because it just goes everywhere. It goes in your wiring, it goes in your stainless steel, and it's very hard to get it out again. But not just that, if it goes to the wire, it can make the wiring brittle and actually, you know, break your MBE if you overdose it with lithium. So again, it's not like, you know, you would just go boldly and put lithium in your MBE chamber. But it should be feasible, and it certainly is possible to grow under equilibrium conditions zinc, arsenic, lithium, and get this structure.
Why do you need MBE to do that?
I don't think that you necessarily need MBE, especially because you don't manganese. There's probably not going to be any solubility problem with manganese, so you need MBE for low temperature, MBE for gallium arsenide, probably not here. And actually, there are ideas around how to make it from precursors and actually, you know, cook it, bake it, and make it even with manganese. So there are ways how to do that too. But the problem is that if you do these methods, usually the crystal quality of these materials is not as high as if you do MBE growth. It's certainly what it's up in the air. People thinking about it.
I like the image.
Shankar's gone, but I'd make a comment on his statement that he made earlier of ignoring some data. So you know, in the spirit of the World Cup, okay, I was making a list as you were talking of things that the K.P description and the tie binding, because here there's not a silver bullet theory that explains it all. Explain some of the data. We have the TC trends, which you showed earlier in the talk, the FMR dynamics, the magnetic dynamics, the calculating the Gilbert damping, to zero. Strange EC axis and isotopies, which is a very non-trivial thing, that's 3-0. Then you have MCB optical data, as Arnold told us when he visited, that's 4-0. Then you have temperature-induced change of anisotropies as well, which is explained through this understanding. Then you have information energies, which you showed, which is also very impressive, since it's independent of India. And then this actually occurred himself, showing the temperature dependence of the metallic systems of the conductivities. And then you have this disagreement, which in this case is the...
Maybe you wait a second.
Oh, there you go. Shankar.
Sorry,
I was making a comment on your comment, so maybe I'll start again. The comment was mainly pointing out that you mentioned that we ignore some data, but in making these statements, of do we understand these things?
Comment was that there is basically everybody agrees that the top picture applies. I hear people in Sunday order, they might agree, and people in Sunday will not agree. That's all I want to know. Okay? Do not drink too much into it.
Okay.
It's not a value judgment I'm making. It may have sounded that way.
Okay, so I took it that way. So I was in the spirit of the World Cup, I was making a list of things that seem to agree with our current understanding and description of gallium manganese arsenide, and things that still need to be worked on and cannot be ignored. That's certainly true, and that's true. Dimitri, and actually we're working with Dimitri as well on trying to understand this, but the score in World Cup terms is, soccer terms, is very lopsided towards the good understanding of gallium arsenide, manganese arsenide, 8-1 according to
Right, but I mean, we have to keep in mind that these are just cartoons and the physics is complicated.
So, not a silver bullet story in this case.
Yeah.
There's nothing that really just.
But, right. But if we wanna talk about how to get TC up and some material issues, I think it's nice to draw these cartoons, although we all agree that these are cartoons and have to be taken with some caution, especially if you discuss complicated properties, complicated optical properties,
and
things like that.
Even if one accepts this cartoon rather critically, let's say, even then, where exactly draw those
it's very hard to say.
It's
exactly.
Entirely up to your own taste.
Uh-huh.
And you have drawn them there because you want gallium manganese arsenide to be in the ball. And Dimitri Bartsov and David Oshawa may draw the unfortunate middle one is here, may draw put gallium arsenide here, all I'm saying. I myself, I don't know. I haven't any papers putting gallium arsenide at all or in the middle, so I'm safe. because I don't do first principles calculations. I don't have a viewpoint, because I do not think that that issue can be settled by using a model effective theory, which is what I do. It's very hard, you know, as you know very well. I mean, I agree with your general approach that you take a model and you do all the possible calculations and try to compare them with experiments, what kind of agreement you get without kind of straining the model too much. My own big feeling is that for optical properties, you have to strain the model tremendously to agree with Bartsov.
He doesn't at the moment.
I mean, he makes some very specific predictions, and Bartsov showed those predictions do not work.
Yeah.
And the predictions we made do work based on a very simple thing. But that doesn't mean that I believe that the manganese arsenide is sedentary. I really am not saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the only point I'd still like to, and we are working on this now with Dimitri, is that I strongly believe that if you want to make any confident conclusion about gallium manganese arsenide, you have to study 15 samples as grown at different stage of annealing and really try to look at different trends. Not just take 3 samples that may be arbitrary and there could be some extrinsic properties of these materials that are not under control.
Okay, so this is a very dangerous line of thinking. What you're saying is that you may not quite be doing experimental
data. No, I didn't say that at all. I just say that according to our experience, you can get easily misled. Although your experimental data are perfectly well taken.
If you have, for example, the example that we had in the early story of this whole business of the magnetization. Now we all understood some of the trends that we saw of this fun magnetization curve, but data was real. I mean, there's certainly nothing unreal about the matrix.
And there are very good theoretical explanations for them. There's nothing funny about them. They explain, you know, that as sample quality improves, magnetization curves should look more and more reliable. That's not that those data were, something is wrong with those data. I do not want to give the feeling that I believe gallium manganese are better than the second gallium. All I'm saying, where one draws those horizontal lines is somewhat arbitrary.
Oh, absolutely.
And two gallium arsenide samples may not make anything.
Absolutely.
In fact, I believe they're not. I believe it does matter, you know, who is going and so on and so forth.
Could you again show the plot where you have TC as a function of the whole concentration of manganese?
Experimental or?
Theory, right?
This one?
No, a little big.
This
one would work, yeah. So that's the right one, whole density of manganese density. I didn't quite understand the trend if you have more than one hole, it's of course not physical, but. If you have lots of holes, manganese, I would guess that TC should go away, right? Because
That's what you see here, right? These are the black dots, and they go down as you increase. You don't see the black. There's another black dot here hidden. So you already see it here. It goes down at high.
But I would expect it to go down more rapidly.
Maybe it never goes down.
Oh no, I mean it should, because we get this acoustic RKKY picture then. If you have more holes than manganese, then your Fermi wavelength is shorter than the manganese operations.
Great lengths on Thursday. The fact of the matter is nobody has calculated the RKKY phase diagram. These are all cartoons. Yeah. RKKY phase diagram simply has not been calculated, but it has been calculated, we posted tonight. Just RKKY phase diagram. With none of this nonsense coming from how complicated the whole band is, whether you have this or you have that, and all these things. First, you have to calculate the RKKY phase diagram accurately for the native RKKY model. And there, what you're saying is absolutely correct. In fact, TC disappears by the time NC over NI is 0.1. This is just a fact. Okay? Now, one may claim because it's valence banded, because a lot of things, it's stable for much, much longer range. That's that one cannot argue. But this is, if I understand it, that shaded part is mean field theory, right? Mean field theory RKKY would be different mechanism for all metazoids. Right? Is this simulation or mean field theory?
I was using these data, which already show some decrease, but it's true that in mean field theory you don't see it. Okay, you have to go beyond mean field theory to see this decrease. Here, probably, while it shows, is probably the role of disorder, I believe. But the cartoon is certainly what's going to apply. So this cartoon is not exactly what applies to numerics behind these data. But I was just unable to show all the, you know, corrected mean field data to show this behavior. So, yeah.
When you're talking about the cartoon, and I'm not an expert in this field,
yes.
I asked me already at the beginning, what is shown in the cartoon? How
here?
Do I interpret these here? Blue and black arrows?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so the cartoon shows the following. This is a cartoon of my cartoon of RKKY interaction. You have one manganese here. Okay,
yep.
One manganese is an impurity, so I always picture impurity like throwing a rock in the water, and that creates waves. So these are density waves that are created of the holes that are created around this impurity. But because this is not a simple impurity, it's a magnetic impurity, it would be an attractive impurity to one spin of the hose and a repulsive impurity to the other spin of the hose. So this spin down of the hose will have a peak near the impurity, while the other one would have a minimum near the impurity. Well, and then they just add together to the to the total magnetization of the holes. And so this total magnetization will oscillate. So it will be ferromagnetically or antiferromagnetic, depends on the sign of the interaction. It will start with one sign near the impurity, and but then eventually it will change sign because of this, you know, Weiss oscillations basically of the two different spins. And so what happens is that if the average distance between manganese is much smaller than the wavelength of these oscillations, which are Fermi wavelength, basically, of the holes, then most of the spins will be coupled ferromagnetically. So the RKKY would lead to ferromagnetism. But if now the hole density becomes too large, that the average concentration between the two moments is let's say between these two peaks here, then you will have some which will be coupled ferromagnetically, some antiferromagnetically, and that leads to frustration.
Okay.
But the issue is, what is this large density? What distinguishes large density from
right.
density?
So certainly, this, if you would do these calculations for a simple parabolic band, for one hole per manganese would be totally in the antiferromagnetic already. So it would be a very, very frustrated system. But it seems like that because of the spin-orbit interaction you have in the valence band, because you don't have a single KF, you have heavy holes, you have light holes, and also these oscillations just comes from the singularity at 2KF of the susceptibility, and that is suppressed if you go to a spin-orbit coupled systems. So all this probably plays in favor of ferromagnetism in these systems. Okay. Now you may ask, okay, so what's going to happen in the n-type system, right? But the n-type system, as we see, is again because of p orbitals, not of the s orbitals. So again, there will be spin-orbit interaction, and so probably the physics can be very similar there, but it has not been certainly studied as to as much detail as the p-types. All this, I think, to me, all these things just tells you that whatever you do, whatever calculation, it's not just these effects, but what band structure you use to start with, even if you put manganese, it all just tells you that you have to take all the predictions for TCU only qualitatively. But it's nice that many different approaches seems to get you a very similar qualitative picture, and there's nothing done quantitatively, so even the fact that we are in the right order of magnitude, I think, gives you some confidence that the theory makes some sense. But I think it's hopeless to hope that we will have the TCUs up to a factor of 1.2 or something like that accurate. So that's hopeless.
Can you check the signals coming from the T-type piece? Because we have the spin-orbit coupling.
Yeah. One complication obviously here is that this is a very nice picture, right? Because this picture translates the complicated correlated and hybridization physics into one simple magnetic interaction. But really, this type of transformation and this simplification applies very well.
It's only in the case of the spin transfer from D to P via the spin state. But in the presence of the spin cutting, you could also free the spin from the collection band. If you hop from the collection band to the provide your phone,
Is your question about what are the similarities or differences between the physics we expect in the valence band and in the conduction band? Or okay, how am I going to say that? Okay. So this is one. Okay, and this would require some extra donors. Acceptors. Okay, but we were interested.
So the physical regime is between 0 and 1, correct? You just wanted to see it in the calculation.
Yeah. Well, the physical regime in this material, if you don't code dope it. Mm-hmm.
So shall we give 5 minutes break to get a coffee?
Yes, please.